Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, two guests. Our first, from Germany, using Skype, is Professor Michael Hudson. He is one of our nation's finest and most important economists and Wall Street financial analyst. Professor Paul Craig Roberts recently called him the world's best economist. He's currently the president of the Institution for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and was the chief economic policy advisor for Representative Dennis Kucinich's presidential campaign. He's the author of many books, including Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroyed the Global Economy, which goes into great depth in explaining how the polarization of the 1% versus 99% emerged. His website is michael-hudson.com. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
It's good to be here.
Our theme in this part of our program is deconstructing the myths around the so-called, you know, prosperous economy. All the talking heads on the economic shows, the financial programs are saying, well, the economy is booming, it's doing very well, that our percentage of unemployment is down around 4.4%, more or less, and things look very good. That said, I'd like to just share a few things here with you and then have you respond. As you see the world economy, you are a special consultant to different governments, plus you certainly are very intimate with the American economy or economies. This is from Sheldon Greaves, he is a scholar on this, and it says, "The New Economy, Unemployment, and the Return of the American Hobo." Quote, "A few years ago, I read somewhere about a trend in the gig economy in which people who had been reduced to living in their cars or RVs roamed the country by the thousands, homeless, nomadic workers driving from one place to another, one temporary job to another. It painted a tragic picture, underpaid, overworked, often lacking health insurance, men and women, many of whom ought to be enjoying retirement, but were working in the warehouses filling orders for Amazon or stocking shelves in big box stores. It sharply reminded me of the Great Depression, another time when mobile workers moved from place to place across the country in search of work. Thinking about this, I realized that what we are seeing was the return of the migrant worker apart from the seasonal farm worker, meaning the hobo. Also called Trump's bums and other less charitable names, these men were the displaced detritus of the Great Depression who wandered the country looking for any job that could help them survive and if there was anything left over to send home to their families. It was a dangerous life. Traveling by hopping freight trains or hitchhiking on the highways wasn't the safest way to get around. Many hobos were maimed or killed in accidents traveling this way or were victims of violence. In fact, Lauren Isley, wonderful in the memoir All the Strange Hours, recalls his days as a young hobo with all the dangers and troubles that went with being a hobo. They also faced hostility from towns naturally suspicious of outsiders. So what he's talking about in this article is that virtually unseen by the American media, not discussed ever by any of the legislators at the state, local, or federal level, are not thousands or hundreds of thousands, but tens of millions of Americans who should be working, had worked, had gainful employment, maybe had quality lives, and now today are reduced to finding any work anywhere, any food anywhere, any shelter anywhere, but no advocates. They're not a part of this recovering, booming economy. A separate piece from Maury Beckman from The Motley Fool, almost half of all Americans die nearly broke. Quote, "Americans aren't known for being great savers. In a recent Go Banking Rate study, 69% of adults admitted to having less than $1,000 in the bank, while 34% said they actually don't have any savings at all." That's 34% of all Americans. But apparently this collective lack of saving doesn't get all that much better with age. a study by the National Bureau of Economic Research found that not so long ago, that almost half of Americans die nearly broke. Of the general population, 46% of retirees die with savings average of less than $10,000 or even smaller amounts. But that number climbs to 57% among retirees who are single. Now, when we take other assets like homes into account, the picture gets a lot less bleak. But that's the reality. The people have a home, but they may have a mortgage that's underwater, or they also may have a home but are spending all their money just maintaining it. Now, we would agree with that because when I was doing the film which you were in, Poverty Inc., we found people who had homes, and from the outside everything looked all right, but you go inside the home and you find that most of the furniture had been sold. All the wealthy things are nice. Things were sold. Heirlooms were sold. And you'd find a single person, an older person more often than not, living in one room just to save on utilities. So again, they're not part of the prospering. Young people graduating from college, 55% are going home and living with their parents because they have no job. So my larger question is this, and I want to take enough time to paint how big this picture really is. We have over 102 million Americans who once work full-time, are now not working or only working part-time. They're not included in that 4.4 very optimistic unemployment rate. When we hear about how well we're doing, why aren't we taking into account all the people who are not supportive or participating in that boom? The forum is yours.
Well, you're right about the statistics you use, but it's not only at the bottom of the scale. It's not only the part-time workers that are suffering. 95% of the American economy has shrunk since 2008. Obviously, the bottom rungs are feeling it the most harshly, the people who are needing to find any kind of labor. And I think it's very good to compare the kind of workers who go to work for Uber or McDonald to migrant labor. That's exactly what they are. They are sort of desperate for jobs, or what in the 18th century was called loom fodder in England, when people were driven off the land to go into the cities and find whatever kind of employment they could find. You're having almost a similar thing today. There's no guaranteed wage. The minimum wage is so low compared to the basic needs that people are desperate to have one or even two jobs, and there are more and more people with more than one job, and yet these jobs no longer go together with medical insurance for part-timers or for pensions, or even if the jobs do have pensions, the new financial management of companies cuts back the pension plans in order to make more profit. So the entire economy is suffering, not just the most obvious parts. There's a slow crash for the middle class as well.
Let us take a look at what it means to be a young person today, deciding about going to college. The average cost now is $36,000 a year. That does not include room and board or books. So you could easily go to $50,000. And yet, we don't have the jobs out there for the majority of these people, except for medical doctors. There are certain about seven careers that you will be able to find some gainful employment, but all the rest you won't. And on top of that, we have these special visas where people with PhDs from India and South Korea are willing to come to the United States and take the job of someone earning, after 25 years, maybe $150,000, and they'll work for $50,000. And that's a big booming business. We have robotics taking the place of workers. And now we have the next generation of advancements in these technologies, which are going to destroy even more. And yet we're not paying attention to this. Americans are not looking at the future and saying, where am I likely to be? Will I have a job? Do I have the skills? And yet people are still going to school as if those skills they're learning in school are keeping up with the technology, and they're not. Could you address what it means to be a young person, since you're also a professor and you work with young people and their needs?
Well, you mentioned robotics, and it's true that robotics are replacing labor, but robotics actually create an even larger demand for labor to make the robots. So there's an increasing employment as a result of robotics. The problem is that all this increasing employment is occurring abroad, mainly in Asia, because the United States cannot afford to make labor that can make robots when it has to pay rents. The average is $4,500 in New York a month. To pay for schools, the $35,000 to $45,000 in student loans, student costs per year. If Americans were to get all of their goods and services for nothing, if they were to get all of their food and transportation and clothing for nothing, they still couldn't afford to go to work making the robotics to disemploy themselves, because their medical care alone is higher than most many people make in foreign countries. Their wage withholding, the taxes, the set-asides for Social Security and medical care, the taxes and the monthly credit card payments leave hardly anything to be left to spend on goods and services here. So that's why, as we've discussed before, the malls are closing down, commercial real estate's going out of business, and stores are closing down all in the major shopping streets of New York. So the problem is the malformation, and all of this is called financialization of the economy. They call this creating wealth, and the wealth in America has actually gone way, way up, but it's all been concentrated in the upper 1 to 5%. It hasn't been shared, and actually, if this wealth of the 1 to 5% takes the form of driving the bottom 95% deeper and deeper into debt and having to pay more of each paycheck in the form of insurance and debt service, you're going to have the situation getting worse and worse and worse in a slow crash.
I also have some concerns that I do not see being addressed in the mainstream or alternative media. And that is, when you look at our economy, there's a lot of debt that can be forgiven. After all, we forgave trillions of dollars of debt for the financial industry. We could do the same for individuals. We could certainly forgive the student debt. That would be relatively inexpensive, and look at what it would mean to the families, to the people who are bearing the burden of that debt. We could make public institutions free of, as New York State recently did, for public education. If you go to a state-run public school, what you would spend if you go to a private university, well, that's between you and the university. But all these things would help, and yet we're not doing that. We're not applying simple techniques to complex problems. So if you were the advisor, if you were on the Council of Economic Advisors, the president, which you should have been, what advice would you give to change our whole future, our debt, and to get the economy running again?
Well, I'd point out, I'd put together statistics, and the statistics would show that the student debt, for the most part, can't be paid in any case. So the question is, how isn't it going to be paid? There are two ways not to pay the student debt. Either you write it off and say education should be free. We made a mistake in letting banks finance education and run you all into debt. We're going to undo the mistake by forgiving the debt. Or else you can let do what they're doing now. Let the banks foreclose. Let the banks foreclose on the parents who've countersigned the debt, so the parents lose their property. Let there to be an even faster sucking up of money to the top. So the refusal to cancel the debts for students and for mortgage debtors and for people who can't declare bankruptcy and wipe out their bank debt anymore, like they used to be able to do, the alternative is for just a wipeout of these classes, making them even more dependent and shrinking the economy all the more, but in the process, making the banks rich, because the government has guaranteed all of these bad debts to the banks. It said that banks, you can charge very high interest rates, higher interest rates than you can make anywhere else, higher interest rates than mortgage debts, because we know student loans are risky. So you get the compensation for risk, but ha-ha, we promise you won't have to take any risk at all. because the government is going to guarantee these debts, and if they can't be paid, then you get to charge huge penalty fees. And we guarantee to pay you all the penalty fees, so the longer you can keep trying to collect these bad debts, the more money you're going to get. And then finally, we'll say enough is enough, and we'll go after the debtors, and we'll make sure that they'll never be able to get a job because of their bad credit rating. We'll be sure that they're just sort of excluded from society. And this is the most polarizing effect on the American economy that there's really ever been here. So no wonder the youth find it different from today. When their parents were young, in right the years after World War II, into the 1950s, 1960s, everybody who graduated could get a job because there was a shortage of labor. And everyone with a job could take out a mortgage and buy a house on terms that would be automatically paid off the whole mortgage within 30 years when their working life was over. And none of that's available anymore. So the world of their parents doesn't exist anymore. And there's a hesitance to realize this because they say, well, the rich people are getting richer so fast that it makes up for all the poverty. And if you look at the overall balance, we're really concerned about how rich the rich are getting, not about how poor the 95% are getting.
Add on to that, if you would, Michael, an honest look, which you will give us and the rest of the media will not. When you look at the gross domestic product, which for the average person is the total amount earned in different ways in our economy, in other words, all the different businesses doing business, there are two figures in there that I believe should be reevaluated. One is today, unlike in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, people were not using their credit cards, didn't have credit cards for some of that period of time, and people were averse to debt. So what you bought, you generally had savings to back up, or you paid with your disposable income. Today, upwards of 5% of the entire gross domestic product is based on people who are so far in debt they have no money, they're kiting credit cards, meaning they'll pay one bill and wait 28 days and then pay another that bill with another credit card, wait 28 days and pay that bill with another credit card. They don't have any money. They're just kiting this along. If the day comes, if they don't have enough credit cards, then they have to pay it. They wouldn't have to pay, but sometimes they could get 5 or 10 different credit cards. So how in the world can we suddenly make debt, meaning a person has no choice, they have to pay for their mortgage this month with their credit card, or they have to pay for something with their credit card, it's not disposable income, it's not part of their savings. And we consider that part of our prospering economy. And then Wall Street makes a minimum of 12% or higher of our gross domestic product. Yet that money on Wall Street does not get shared with the rest of the economy. It's not used for building businesses, it's not used for small businesses, it's not used for infrastructure. So it stays within the corporations within the financial sector. Well, then why use that as a basis of showing how prosperous we are when the money is not distributed to the other 99% of the people? And then look at Wall Street. Every day it's getting closer to another record, and Trump is taking credit for this. Oh, we've had 33% increase in the value of our equity market. That's trillions of dollars, I think $3 trillion. And he and the Republicans are taking credit for that. And people think that must mean everything is prosperous, everything is good. And the investors say, put it into these stocks, put it in these bonds. And they don't have any idea. This is all a bubble. It's a bubble that ultimately is going to have a correction. Could you explain then these three phenomena to us?
Well, it's a very important point you're making. It's a point, by the way, that I talk about in J is for Junk Economics, where I go into the economic model. Yeah, let's say you were talking about the money that Wall Street makes, the 12% of the GDP. And you pointed out, quite right, that they don't make this money by actually producing a product or goods and services. So why on earth would this income be counted as part of gross domestic product? It's not a product. These are fees that it charges for transferring property. And transferring property doesn't have anything to do with production. It's a transfer of ownership of who's going to own the house, who's going to own the corporate stocks or bond, what raider is going to get what corporation. None of this has to do with product. So the pretense is that all of this money that Wall Street's making that has nothing to do with the economy and, in fact, is sucked out of the economy, instead of subtracting that 12% from the economy because it's income that's sterilized, that the economy can't afford to use on goods and services, the pretense is that this is added to output, giving the illusion of growth while actually the economy is shrinking. That's what really should be done by restructuring economic statistics to show just what you're showing. It could be done very easily in principle, but it's very tedious in practice because the way the government is sort of linked up the computer files. But you know, with a year's work, anybody could sort of could have an alternative national income report on the economy every year to say, here's what the economy would look like if you depict it like it really is, with Wall Street simply doing a zero-sum activity, extracting money from the economy, what economists call economic rent, instead of actually producing anything.
Could you also talk about the illusion that we're booming because Wall Street just keeps going up and the strength of the dollar keeps the value of a person believing it, the value of the illusion that the economy is great because the dollar's strong, Wall Street is breaking new records, more people who have money are making even more money, and that's what everyone's focusing on. They're focusing upon the people who are making money, their new yachts. A lot of millennials who have gotten their advanced education are working generally within the financial industry, but a few other industries as well, like in advertising or the media. They're not going out and buying the big houses. What they're doing frequently is spending that money on their own health, their own vacations, quality of life issues that don't necessarily show as it historically would have. Like historically, you buy the house, you buy the car, you have the family, all the stuff that went into getting the house, you have to, you know, all the furnishings. And that is the old model. The new model is young people say, I don't need to have a house, but I do want to have dinner tonight. And there's a great place. It's a beer bar. By the way, this is a true story. I have the menu. And the average beer is $85 for a beer. But it's exotic beers and heirloom beers. And it's packed. How do I know? The other night coming back from Lincoln Center, I dropped in there, and it was packed. And I said, how long's it been? Oh, all night. We're packed from clear up to closing, like 150 seats. And I looked at the menu. I took one with me, and you're not talking about the food is expensive, like a half a head of a pig was $85. Now, who are these people? So I stood there. I said, do you mind if I just want to look at the menu? And I'm looking around. I'm looking at every table. I'm guessing the average age was between 28 and 34 years of age. And these are people making enough money that they want to spend it on that, or they want to spend it on a vacation someplace, or they want to spend it on going to an exclusive spa or exclusive gym. So there's a whole lot of people, several million people, spending their money on quality of life, but not necessarily on the consumer items that historically would have been a part of the old economic model. Then you have people who are just too poor to spend money from their own generation on anything. They just stay and they surf the internet nonstop. In fact, the number one source of internet view each day, 85 million people go to one single outlet for porn per day, every 24 hours, 85 million throughout the world, but a lot of them Americans. So a lot of people are not working. A lot of people are working and not spending their money the way they historically would have, and which would have meant that it would have been spread around a village. Used to be when I was growing up, you were growing up, a dollar went around a village about 68 times. Today it's less than 7. So we don't look at that, and we don't look at Wall Street for what it is. Could you explain in the remaining time what Wall Street actually is, what confidence or lack of confidence we should have in that we've got this great booming economy? Because look at Wall Street, set a new record. Look at the strength of the dollar. Look at all these trendy restaurants and trendy places downtown. Look at the cost of an apartment in Manhattan and in Brooklyn. And that's what they're valuing everything at today, instead of pulling back to see all the other people and all the other circumstances we're living with.
Well, when it comes to the stock market, the question is, who own these stocks? About 10% of the population own something like 3/4 of all the stocks. So a very small 1/10 of the population, just the decimal point, actually gets all of the capital gains from these earnings. Now, that leads right into your second point about the students that are spending the money. And you say, you know, somebody's earning an awful lot of money. Well, not necessarily. I wonder whether these students are spending their own money or are living on trust funds. For instance, when you talk about New York University costing, I think, $45,000.
New York University, $67,000. New York University,
$67,000. Okay, now. More and more students at NYU and other universities are foreign students. I guarantee you these foreign students do not qualify for student loans, so they don't borrow the money, and they're certainly not working to earn this money each year. They're paid for by the parents, and the parents also will come very often and buy them an apartment in New York near the university. So they have an apartment, they buy the education, and I can assure you with parents like that that are cleaning up so much money in the stock market, we're talking about the 10%, they can afford to give the students enough money to eat out at your $85 a dinner bars. So a lot of this is simply inherited wealth, and the economy is bifurcating not only between the financial sector and the rest of the economy, but by young people who inherit money and have trust funds and the disinherited. And most of the economy, of course, are the disinherited. They have to actually earn their money to rise in society, but they don't have the opportunity to rise in society any longer because the last generation of people's parents made their money by rising value of their houses that were all inflated on credit. And now that game is over. Instead of houses being inflated on credit, you have the stock market inflated in credit. And the stock market is going up and up and up, not because people are buying more and putting it in the market, but because banks are lending more and more against stocks, especially in Europe. They've lent another $1 trillion in the last month. $1 trillion, or not in euros in this case, just to inflate the stock market. So the central banks are pushing the market up for the benefit of the 10% of the population that own the lion's share of stocks.
Final question for you. When you take a look at our society, what would be the message for the average person looking forward, what they should trust in, what they should do to help hedge against the uncertainties of this administration and its economic and social policies?
Well, I wouldn't say trust in anything right now. And it's not really an uncertainty. It's pretty much a certainty that things are going to get worse and worse and worse. There's very little hope. So I don't know what they can do. Now that the Democratic Party has moved to the right of the Republican Party, there doesn't seem to be any neither party, as it's presently structured, is going to do anything to help people survive. And in fact, both parties are financed by Wall Street and by the property owners now that politics has been privatized and made part of the private sector. So not a problem that can be solved. It's really a quandary. There's no solution that can be made that I can see without radically changing the system. And most people are unwilling to be radical because that's not nice. So if you want to be extroverted, if you want to be liked by your friends, don't do anything. Just starve very quietly and without complaint. That's the only advice I have. Just be quiet and starve without complaining, or else be a radical. Those are the two choices.
Well, there's a big cheerleader on one side of that equation, Chris Hedges. He's been saying, hey, it's time to radicalize. And I want to thank you very much for being on today. Michael, you're always ahead of that curve, and it's always nice to hear what you have to offer us. Thank you.
It's always good to be here. I really like your show.
Professor Michael Hudson. His website is michael-hudson.com. His latest book, Killing the Host: How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroyed the Global Economy. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break and come right back with our next guest. Please stay with us.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. In the second part of our program, after Professor Michael Hudson, we're going to continue with our conversations with remarkable minds and also discuss the collapse of the American middle class and the racial underpinnings between the growing gap between the rich and the poor. Sharing insights in this hour would be Professor Peter Timmon. He is the Gray Professor of Economics. He's emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, where he's been teaching since 1961. He has specialized in the economic development of labor, central banks, and social welfare programs, and the monetary forces during the Great Depression. He received his undergraduate degree from an important school, and then his doctorate from MIT. He also holds fellowships at Harvard and the Guggenheim Fellow as well. He's authored 20 books. His most recent is The Vanishing Middle Class, Prejudice and Power in a Dual Economy, which argues that the gradual disappearance of the middle class is following a trajectory found in poor developing nations. Nice to have you with us today.
Okay, thank you.
If we are to believe our news financial analysts and the government's employment reports, we might feel that the country is in pretty good shape. And when Obama left office, the Democrats raved about the economic uptick during Obama's last 2 years in office. However, if we descend to the ground level, another picture emerges. One is the noticeable sign that the middle class is in decline. What I hear from the mainstream is a type of denialism regarding the erosion of the middle class, or worse, its disappearance altogether. The health of the nation is based upon skewed configurations such as the gross domestic product, up and downs in the stock market, and jobs reports. Yet, as a famous Polish scholar once stated, the map is not the territory, and the gross domestic product doesn't reveal how the average American lives. The stock market only benefits the bank accounts of a small percent of Americans, and job reports out of the White House hide what kind of actual jobs are being filled. And also, when you no longer are looking for a job, even though you were gainfully employed, or you've run out of benefits for being on unemployment insurance, you no longer count. So when I read how Forbes criticized your recent work, The Vanishing Middle Class, I have to ask, why is it that when it comes to the United States sinking into a third world status for some, or a banana republic for others, that there's such a denialism of the plain evidence before us and how the average American family is surviving? So I appreciate your views about the denialism among politicians, the financial elite, the policymakers, the media pundits, about the gradual demise of the middle class. The forum is yours.
Well, yes. Well, the way I divide people is into two groups. The top group is the kind of largely self-educated group and a largely educated, college-educated group. And they tend to live by themselves increasingly in neighborhoods of like-minded people, send their kids to decent schools, and promote them going on to college, and they're in reasonably good jobs. And they seem largely unaware of what is happening either further out into the countryside or further into the city in the inner cities, where jobs have flown. And there are people often without a college education who were educated for factory jobs when they existed, for clerkships, say, in banks or other financial institutions when those jobs existed, and they are now floundering around. And so the signs of well-being are measured by the unemployment rate, which is defined as those people actively looking for jobs. But people in the countryside where the jobs have gone, or in the inner city where the jobs also have gone, don't look for jobs because there aren't any jobs there. And so they tend not to be counted. And so you get a two-tiered discussion where the people in what I call the FTE sector, finance, technology, electronics sector, go about their business, and they don't care about what is happening in the rest of the country.
Okay, well, I appreciate that insight. Just today, I was reading that 1,000 stores have closed just recently. We're talking about in the last week. And in the last 10 months, 100,000 Americans who worked in those stores have lost their job. There's no discussion of this at all, that the malls are going empty. They were once booming. Now they're not, because the internet has taken up the slack and is now leading a lot of these people out there. And you're talking about a huge market, like somewhere around $5 trillion is what it's valued at, and it's dying. So we're not talking about this. We're not showing what happens when a store closes. And I walk down Manhattan. I live in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. And walking from 90th Street down to Lincoln Center at 63rd Street, I counted 47 stores out of business just this week. That they were there recently, now they're gone. So we're not paying attention to the basics here. Could you explain a little more in depth why we're not caring about all these stores closing, the employees that live there? What's going on with our psyche?
Okay, well, this is a continuation of the trends chronicled in my book. And in this case, the shopping malls are disappearing, as you say, because of continued progress, the internet and sellers over the internet for that. And independent stores are closing for some of the same reasons that the economics are that favors larger aggregations for business because you can automate the back office, and you can then buy products in bulk. And these days, with rapid cargo transportation, you can get your merchandise from any place in the world very rapidly. And so this is a kind of setting in which kind of people for workers are becoming increasingly superfluous. Now, I'm interested that this has gotten to the west side, the Upper West Side of Manhattan, because that's a prosperous area. And so you would think that other people walking the streets would see what's happening there. You can see it in Cambridge with the commercialization of Harvard Square, where the independent stores have largely left, and you're left with outlets of chains, you know, a CVS and, you know, chains of other sorts of kind of operations. And this represents this kind of progress where the people who have been let go by the malls in the suburbs and by these independent stores in the cities have trouble finding other jobs. So they find very short-term jobs, the so-called gig economy, where you work, you know, it's the system we used to associate with common laborers. Now, these people have some skills, but the particular skills they have are not the ones in demand at the moment. And so they are there. Our government doesn't seem to be aware of them. It was aware in the campaign and appealed to the, particularly in the mid, appealed to people largely in the Midwest who were couldn't find jobs and were very loyal to their communities and very opposed to the idea of blacks or immigrants coming in and taking the few jobs that there were. And so appealed to a very continuous trope in American history, starting in the 17th century, with slavery continuing through Jim Crow and all sorts of states' rights things, which are really very much in evidence today. And so, but aside from that, you know, a lot of these people, the young people, are moving back with their parents because they can't afford a house. They have high education loans, which destroys their purchasing power because they have to pay the interest on the loan. And so they don't settle down. They don't begin to make families and so on. And it gets to be the destruction of a community, or perhaps better stated, it's the destruction of the community, but it's not the same people. It's that the new people coming in don't have the positions that the old people had going out. And so the community changes, but it's a generational change as well as a change in the community.
One large group of Americans we rarely hear about are those living in rural, non-urban areas. The nonprofit group Feeding America reports that 17% of residents in rural America live in extreme poverty. And earlier this year, the CDC released a report that rural Americans are at a highest risk of death from five leading illnesses, which are otherwise largely preventable. In recent years, life expectancy in rural areas is decreasing dramatically, so there's an enormous disparity in economic mobility and the quality of education and social programs and funding between rural and urban America, and this would seem to confirm the presence of a dual economy of rich and poor is common in poor developing countries. The upward mobile 20% you were just referring to are primarily well-educated and working in the financial, technological, and electronic sectors, not rural occupations. Would you please speak about this problem in rural America? And is it fair to say that the attitude the wealthy elite holds towards rural working class still carries some earlier attitudes of slavery mixed with racism?
Yes, that the model that I use in my book is a model where the progressive class, the FTE sector, does not care at all about the people who are stranded that you've just described. And in this case, they are kept down by the neglect and in a sense by the one kind of economic activity that this group, the FTE, the rich group, likes to engage in is military. We have a volunteer military, and so these people in the rural area with no jobs, no progress, people dying, the military is a good alternative for them. And so this provides, in a sense, the fodder for these people to run their wars. And so while all of these people say what they want is a small government, no regulation of industry, no federal rules on employment and so on, they are happy to have an overblown military.
I want you to add on to that, if you would, please, because you have put forth the argument that the decline of the middle class, in part, has a deep strata of racism underneath its causes. The orgy to privatize everything, such as our public schools under Betsy DeVos, our privatized prison system, are some manifestation of this. Please explain why, and can you trace the roots of the middle class collapse, the institutionalization of racism in our culture, and how do you see this underlying racism being played out in Trump's proposed economic policies and budget?
Okay. When this whole development started in the 1970s, it started with the combination of Nixon's Southern strategy with the war in Vietnam, with a lot of this, and with the war on drugs. And the war on drugs was, as it has been characterized, a new Jim Crow. Drug penalties were set much higher for the kind of drugs that were used by urban blacks than they were for suburban whites. And so we have a large prison complex. The large prison complex, where at the moment one out of three black men can anticipate going to jail in his lifetime. That's a stupendous fact. Then that kind of destroys the community, first by taking so many people out of the community, second of all, because then the poor people or the children growing up are poor, they're headed by single-headed, they're in single, female-headed, single parent families, which are poor, so the kids are sent to poor schools. They don't have a good attitude because they don't expect to finish school. They expect that they have a very good chance of going to jail. And so the policies that get applied by the FTE sector vilify the black community and say to the whites, who are particularly the rural whites, even though they can't find a job, at least they're better off than the urban blacks. And so they're appealing to this strain of racism that goes through American history, and the attitude of the rural whites, particularly in the Midwest, and, of course, in the South, seems to be that no matter how bad I'm off, at least I have my, what shall we call it, my dignity, my moxie, my individuality, whatever it is, that is because I am not black. And so the policies then are based on this kind of myth that all of the public support for schools and so on would go to undeserving blacks, undeserving African Americans. But of course, there aren't that many African Americans to go around. There are plenty of white youths in terrible schools, in cities and also in the country. And so the kind of rules and the privatization that DeVos is urging for schools will destroy the schools for all the young people coming in. That'll be African Americans, Latino immigrants, and then the majority of white young people who are poor. And these are the children of all of these people who are having trouble getting jobs and so on, and so they'll be poor, and they will not have options there. But if you listen to the rhetoric of it, it's all about blacks. all about African Americans. And there's very little talk about the whites who are suffering this way. But Trump, in his candidacy, assured these white families that they would have good schools, they would have good health care, they would have new jobs. Once in office, he has reneged on all of these promises.
I have a question and a statement that if you find any validity into it, you can address it. If not, it's fine. But I believe that we are not looking in the right places for solutions. I believe that there's so much politicalization within our educational system, so much money does not end up improving the educational standards or the environment which most public schools need. We don't even have recess or places for kids, a playground for many of the younger kids to go out. They're being overcoached for teaching so that the score is what is important, not did they learn any critical teaching skills so they could apply those to life situations. And so I believe that we are educating a lot of people to become nothing more than functionally illiterate about the world we live in, about our history, about other cultures, about the geography and the political elements within that geography, about different religions. And about at least nine million millionaires in the United States, and they have an average of four people per family. So let's just say there's two kids per family. So what we're not looking at is that we have a very strong two-tiered system. One is public school, which now most people don't want to go to. It's been relegated to, oh, you have to go there. Oh, you're not bright enough. You didn't get the scholarship. Your parents are not rich enough. And then we have the public private schools like Harvard or, you know, New York University. New York University, I believe, is $67,000 a year, one of the most expensive in America. And now you look at about 18 million young people. They can't afford anything, pretty much. The parents buy them the apartments or rent the apartments. They can go to any school. They don't have to worry about that. And they don't even have to worry about if they have a job when they get out or not. But the vast majority do. And I believe that part of the problem, and again, this is my own subjective opinion, part of the problem is that we have evolved the sense of elitism, including at your own alma mater, Harvard. If you really care about just educating to the best quality standards you can, then why are all these schools competing with the new stadiums and swimming pools and all these other amenities that really don't have anything to do with, are we teaching kids what they need in order to function in the real world that's changing today? And I believe that they are woefully inadequate in that, and yet they're extreme in their hubris to look at their own needs without looking at the total educational system as a whole. Your final thoughts, please.
Okay. Well, it appears that you have accepted the idea of a dual economy very completely. And so let me separate that from other things that you said. First of all, there is a dual educational system, the Harvard's and MIT's and so on, and the schools, as you described, the private schools, suburban schools are pretty good too. And the people who go to them are largely unaware of what is happening in the rest of the economy. That is the other 80% of the economy. Now, you describe conditions in that other 80% where people are just taught to be barely literate, not taught about art or music or anything like that. This is all the consequence of starving educations for money, that they are not having enough money to attract good teachers. They don't have money to build new school buildings. They don't have money to get the lead out of the pipes going under the old school buildings to the fountains that the kids drink from. And it goes on because we are not supporting education. And one of the things that we know is that the productivity of America depends on innovation. And we don't know which individual will be innovative. But we do know that if we have more educated people who know something about the world and maybe some music or maybe some poetry for all of that kind of thing, that some of these people will innovate and lead our economy forward. But if we waste the potential of 80% of the population by educating them narrowly, if at all, then we decrease the number of people who are capable of being innovative in this economic way. And America will largely be relegated to third world status. Our kind of schools, our infrastructure, our urban amenities all are beginning to look that way. The American Society of Civil Engineers gives us a D plus, I think, for the state of our infrastructure. People who commute have extraordinary delays in New York on the Long Island Railroad, just announced, in the subways with 50-year-old cars going for that. That's true in all urban subway systems for that. And this is because we have developed this large degree of income inequality, as you talked about with your millionaires, where the top tier of the country feels it can go on independent of what happens in the rest of the economy. And I think that is fundamentally wrong. Each individual may be able to get rich and then have a house on the Riviera for that. But for the United States as a whole to prosper, we need to invest in our people. And the dual economy structure of the country at the moment, as expressed in my book, The Vanishing Middle Class, makes that very, very difficult.
Well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming on and sharing these very profound insights with us. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
My guest, Professor Emeritus at Harvard, or Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Professor Peter Temin, T-E-M-I-N, author of The Vanishing Middle Class. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.